Hi, it's Diane. On my mind,
we've never had a team lose so badly. You're all fired. All four are fired.
It's hard to remember a time when this is what Donald Trump was best known for, his reality show, The Apprentice. But the New York Times chief television critic says this is exactly what we need to think about in order to understand Donald Trump, how he shaped his image for the American public long before coming to the presidency, and how he continues to do so today. James Poniewozik's new book is Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. I spoke with him Tuesday morning. James, I want to go back to when Trump is elected in 2016. There's this passing reference to his television career, and I gather that really baffles you.
Yeah, when Trump was running, but particularly after he was elected, because this was a shock to a lot of the pundit class and arguably even to Trump's own campaign and his opposition. But we started seeing all these explainers, you know, how did we get Trump? How did this momentous moment happen? And I would see him discussed as, you know, a political demagogue, a populist, a Manhattan real estate mogul. The description was used very often. And certainly his career as a TV star was mentioned, but it was generally treated as, you know, sort of, you know, ancillary. It was a secondary thing that evolved out of those other pursuits. As somebody who has written about and covered Donald Trump as an author and a TV figure for a couple of decades now, and has known him as a popular culture figure for a couple of decades before that, to me, that was entirely backwards. Donald Trump was always first and foremost a celebrity who sought to be a celebrity, who cultivated and sought out a presence in the media and became a TV and talk show, et cetera, figure. And then learned, because, you know, he realized quite accurately that in a media culture, one can leverage that celebrity into other fields, be it business, be it licensing your name as a brand to other people to develop things, be it television stardom, be it Fox News stardom, and ultimately, of course, as we saw, into politics. You know, to me, TV wasn't an interesting sidelight of Donald Trump's success. It was the entire point of him, and I didn't see anybody really delving into that with a deep understanding of the medium.
And what do you think it is that makes Trump so well-suited for television?
He likes conflict. His personality is about aggression. He has a sense of what the camera wants, which is sensation, which is, you know, a show. He knows that a television camera is this sort of hungry beast that always wants something spicier than the last thing that you fed it. And we've seen that demonstrated in stage after stage of his career. Going back to the 1980s, when he had the perfect timing to be coming up as sort of this swaggering, braggadocious emblem of the, you know, rapacious, money-hungry Reagan era, going through his heyday on NBC and on The Apprentice, and certainly going into the 2016 presidential campaign, where much of his success owed to the fact that he knew how to keep a camera light on. And when you do that, you make yourself the protagonist of the election, and that helps you control its story.
You know, it's so interesting. Even the faces he makes when he's on television seem to somehow grab that much more attention.
Yeah. You know, that's why he lends himself so well to GIFs and little memes on social media, you know, many of which were made out of the faces that he would pull during the debates. He is very conscious of his presentation. He is very much camera aware. A great story that I came across while I was doing the various research for the book was that when he was running for president, when he would do an interview with a news outlet, he would ask them to play it back. Sound off, so that he could see how he would look to somebody who, you know, just had the TV on but wasn't necessarily paying attention to the sound that was coming out of it, because that picture that you present within those four corners, that is, you know, 95% of who you are in today's media sphere.
But James, take us back to August 21, 1988, and Donald Trump's television appearance on that day.
It was a simpler time. We were so much more innocent.
Yeah.
That was the day that Donald Trump first appeared on national television on the Today Show with Tom Brokaw.
Take a look at my next guest. There's a reporter on Wall Street that this is what he has in mind. This is Donald Trump, 33 years old.
And as I say in the book, that was when, quote unquote, Donald Trump, the TV character, essentially was born. The multimedia performance that he would inhabit for years afterwards. And Brokaw wanted to talk to him that day about his plans for Trump Tower. And those were being written up around the time in the New York City tabloids, where Donald Trump had made himself a fixture. This was the first sign of his, you know, talent for feeding the media beast. You get attention in the tabloids, that gets you on TV. You get on national TV, suddenly you're a national presence in all of these people's homes. And Brokaw was asking him about Trump Tower, its building, the plans. There were some controversies around it. They destroyed some Art Deco friezes on the old Bonwit Teller building that it replaced, to the consternation of New York preservationists. The thing that I found interesting about this, if I can detail it a little bit, is that on the one hand, in the broad strokes, it's very much the Donald Trump character that we've seen on television for decades after. Swaggering, confident, you know, a little cocky, but in sort of an entertaining kind of devil-may-care way. But it's also much more soft-spoken, much more calming, reassuring, trying to sort of diffuse controversies rather than court them.
Mr. Trump, what's left in your life? You're 33 years old. You're worth all this money. You say you didn't say that you want to be worth $1 billion.
No, I really don't. I just want to keep busy and keep active and be interested in what I do. And that's all there is to life as far as I'm concerned. I really am not looking to make tremendous amounts of money. I'm looking to enjoy my life. And if that happens to go with it, that's fabulous.
And part of the argument of my book is that that's important, not just to show how Donald Trump kind of changed and his presentation changed over the years. That is a big part of how media changed over the years. That was the way you would present yourself on television back then, because the kind of television you had in 1980, you know, in the mid-20th century, was a three-network medium. It was a media monoculture where tens of millions of people watched the same thing, and you had to present something that was broadly palatable. And part of the story of how we got from there to here, it's not just the story of, you know, Donald Trump's life in the media, but it's the story of how media itself has changed from that to today, when we have thousands of cable channels, thousands of social media feeds, you know, millions of social media feeds, all these media created niche markets and bubbles, which create a more polarized audience, and in many forms, in many different genres, allow for more polarizing characters to emerge and develop followings. And Donald Trump, we see, kind of evolved with that media.
But the question I have is, did he evolve naturally by his own instincts, or did he have some coaching? Did he simply have a sensibility of where the medium was going?
I think it was more instinctual than coaching. I mean, Donald Trump has always tended to be his own media coach and his own media handler. I mean, going back to the 1980s, when he famously liked to get on the phone with the reporters and say that he was John Barron, press spokesman for Donald Trump, to today, when he basically, the big part of his job is he's basically his own press secretary. His press secretary doesn't give press briefings anymore, but Donald Trump jawbones with reporters on the White House lawn instead. So, you know, I think it was more having an intuition for how people become celebrities and what the camera wants. And when I say that he did that, I want to be clear. Number one, I'm not interested in sort of, you know, psychologizing who, you know, the real deep down Donald Trump is, because I honestly feel that in somebody who is such a public figure, that media performance is by far the most important thing about him. But number two, I don't want to suggest that there was a master plan, you know, that he sat down at some point in the 1970s and sketched out his path through New York real estate to primetime TV to the White House. But I think he knew on a gut level what TV wanted, and TV is very much a gut medium.
Yep. Something else happened back there in 1980, the movie Caddyshack. And in it is a character that you say perfectly illustrates Donald Trump.
This is Rodney Dangerfield's character, Al Cervic. And to quickly describe Caddyshack, it was this 1980 comedy about a country club, a golf club. And the golf club was run, like the big shot at the golf club was this stuffy rich guy named Judge Smales, played by Ted Knight. And his adversary through the movie was Al Cervic, a real estate developer who was tremendously rich, but crass and rude, and he shot off his mouth and he insulted people, and he was hugely entertaining. Rodney Dangerfield was not meant to be the star of Caddyshack, but the dailies from his shoots were just so entertaining that they beefed up his role, and he kind of ran away with it. The figure that Dangerfield was playing, you know, on the one hand, it sort of, you know, stems out of his whole I don't get no respect shtick. But also, this was an interesting moment in popular culture because we're on the verge of the 80s, where we're going from the 1970s and 60s, when nobody really liked rich people in pop culture, to the cusp of the Reagan era. And what Al Cervic is he's a model, sort of an archetype for a kind of rich guy that people will identify with. The guy who is so rich, he doesn't have to care about what other people think.
Hey, orange balls, I'll have a box of those. Give me a box of those naked lady tees, and give me two of those. Give me six of those. Oh, this is the worst looking hat I ever saw. Well, you buy a hat like this, I'll bet you get a free bowl of soup, huh?
It's like you as a rich person. I can, you know, live like a lottery winner, but I don't have to change my behavior. I don't have to suck up to all these stuffy people. You know, I can just let my freak flag fly and be me. Al Cervic, if you watch the 2016 Republic debates, in many ways, that's the character Donald Trump's playing. You know, he's positioning himself against these patricians like Jeb Bush, like Mitt Romney, who wasn't running but was a prominent establishment Republican critic of him, who were basically, this fellow will sully our club if we make him our nominee. And I think what a lot of people who underestimated him, particularly in the Republican primary, didn't see was that there was this base that had been cultivated by a lot of factors, but partly by the way popular culture puts archetypes in all of our minds, to kind of embrace this loudmouth, trash-talking rich guy once we saw him up on a debate stage.
So then by the 1990s, you've got Trump establishing himself as this rich businessman who can do whatever he wants. But to what extent did the reality match up?
Well, that's the funny thing. When we get to the end of the 80s, in Trump's business career, famously, he overextends himself. He takes on too much debt, runs into terrible business troubles, bankruptcies, et cetera. He has to sort of throw himself on the mercy of his creditors. And he is placed on an allowance by his creditors in order to maintain his lifestyle, to maintain the image. Because at that point, the business of the Trump Organization had become the name Trump, the brand. He was the mascot of that brand, just like Colonel Sanders was the mascot of KFC. And he had to keep playing this character. He had to keep representing this cartoon image of what does a fabulously rich guy look like in the public image, because that that gave the brand worth, and his creditors would lose money if he didn't keep it up. So basically, his job becomes to play Donald Trump on TV. He does things like, you know, cameos on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Spin City and The Drew Carey Show and The Nanny. He appears in Home Alone 2 with Macaulay Culkin. He becomes sort of an increasingly parodic character who kind of shows up as this symbol of flashy New York wealth, but that also keeps his brand alive, and it keeps him established in the public mind as your kind of go-to visual when you need a symbol of flashy New York wealth. That's Donald Trump, and that the persistence of that symbol, basically the performance of Donald Trump had to save the actual Donald Trump. That was what made him perfect to be cast in The Apprentice by Mark Burnett in 2004.
Short break. When we come back, more from James Poniewozik. His new book is titled Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with James Poniewozik. You're making me wonder just how much influence Donald Trump had on the evolution of television and the behaviors we see on television, how much he had an impact on that, or whether he was following what he saw.
I think it's a kind of symbiosis. I mean, Donald Trump really, television was kind of his invisible twin. You know, he was born in 1946. That means that he was born when American commercial television was being born. And he's one of the, you know, first baby boomer generation to grow up with TV as a part of his life. Certainly, I think if you look at things like reality TV's depiction of wealth and glamour, the fabulous mansions on The Bachelor, Rick Rockwell, the guy who in 2000 was sort of auctioned off by Fox as a groom on Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire.
Right.
You know, all these kind of farcical pictures of wealth. Well, Trump was kind of playing that character back in the 80s. He was reality TV before reality TV existed. I wouldn't say he did it single-handedly by any means, but he was an active part of the culture at the time who is establishing some of these types.
So let's move now to The Apprentice that debuts in January of 2004. What did that show do for Trump? How did it prepare him for his presidency?
So, number one, The Apprentice takes all this symbology of wealth that Trump has been building around him. You know, the Trump Tower apartment, the helicopter with his name on it, all these props for the show, as he once called them. And it builds a show around them. And it polishes them up. It puts TV production values on it in a show that needs to build up his reputation and his apparent legitimacy because it needs to be legitimate, right? For The Apprentice to be the best reality show, it's got to have the best host and the best prize, which is basically Donald Trump because the contestants are competing for a job with the Trump Organization. So number one, it's just a 14-season PR project for him. Number two, it creates a new media persona for him. It makes him a star through the famous boardroom scenes in which he'd gather up all the contestants from the losing teams and grill them, and they'd try to ingratiate themselves to him and beg for his mercy. And at the end, you're fired, right? He's got a catchphrase.
Right.
He's like Bart Simpson. He's entered that pantheon of breakout TV stars who, you know, just the face and a gesture and a two-word phrase that communicates a whole persona. He becomes the you're fired guy. And it makes him a big star in a way that he'd always wanted to be and had never been before. And I think, you know, ultimately usefully to his political career, it sort of associates him with a bunch of qualities that he would associate himself with as a candidate. Straight shooter. You know, he may not always be nice, but he does what's got to be done and he applies harsh judgment when necessary. He's decisive. He is feared and honored and looked up to. And he is somebody who thrives in conflict. And a big part of his brand as Fox News personality and then as candidate and as president is fighter. The guy who fights, will fight for you. And The Apprentice certainly burnishes that, as well as just, you know, it hands him this trove of valuable imagery. When he starts his presidential campaign in 2015, he comes down the escalator of Trump Tower. That shot, or a version of it, was used over and over on The Apprentice. And TV directors know why this works. You use something like that because it's a power position. You're gliding down from on high in this shiny conveyance, and it just makes you look like a golden god. And he just borrowed that back for his presidential campaign.
And, of course, at the same time, we had no idea about the amount of debt he had incurred. What we were interested in was his seeming strength as he showed on television.
Exactly. He had the benefit of editors on The Apprentice. And they would say that their job was make Trump look wealthy, make him look strong, make him look legitimate. And it came down to things like, very often, producers who have been interviewed would later say, in those boardroom firing scenes, Trump would make a decision and fire somebody who hadn't done anything bad in the week's competition. He would get irritated with them for some reason or something like that. There was no apparent logic to it. So they would have to go back and they would edit logic onto it, because reality TV is you shoot hundreds of hours of footage and then you edit it to tell the story you want to tell. So they would tell the story that made it make perfect sense that Donald Trump made this decision and that it was the correct decision. So that definitely, on a professional level, helped create an image of strength and infallibility for him.
And, of course, you mentioned Fox News. He becomes part of Fox and Friends.
This was a thing that, even as somebody who writes a lot about cable news and who followed Donald Trump and who followed TV and politics for a long time, I was even struck by going back and researching it and watching all his appearances to research for this book. Donald Trump was, and he got this gig largely through being the host of The Apprentice and The Celebrity Apprentice, was a regular commentator on Mondays with Trump for 4 years, from 2011 to 2015, when he launches his presidential campaign. Fox and Friends, of course, is Fox's morning show. We all know it now as the president's favorite news program that basically sets the news agenda for the day and controls our world. But what it also was it's Fox's morning show. It's kind of news and kind of entertainment. And that was the perfect environment in which to pour over Donald Trump, who was a figure who was kind of news and kind of an entertainer. And he first appears on it largely to talk about Celebrity Apprentice and why did he fire Gary Busey or whoever. And he starts working in more and more political talk, particularly bashing the Obama administration, which he was no fan of, as the birther crusade around that time showed. And that catches fire with the Fox audience. Here's a Hollywood celebrity who is on their side for once. And he's telling them that he's as mad as they are, and all the stuff that they believe in, even the conspiracies, he believes it too. And it's this tremendous bonding experience for this devoted base that Fox itself had already spent a couple of decades cultivating and attaching to itself, and they attached to Donald Trump. I honestly think people talk a lot about how important The Apprentice was to getting Donald Trump elected. I think Fox News was at least as important, if not more.
Well, you also talk about the marriage between cable news and reality TV, including CNN. So what did all that mean for Trump's presidential campaign?
Cable news and reality TV in some ways operate on the same principles. And I should say this, by the way, as somebody who watches and enjoys a ton of reality TV. I'm not just saying this, you know, looking down on it, but it's an entertainment medium. It is an entertainment medium that depends on provocation and shocking twists, and every dramatic reveal has to be more dramatic than the last one. Well, it's a business. It is a business that is 24-hour news, which is different from, you know, a half-hour news a day like you had in the broadcast network era before it.
Right.
And so its business model is always make people excited, always get people worked up, breaking news, even if it broke 8 hours ago, right? That's the whole business model. So in that sense, and this is not to say that, you know, all cable news is garbage or anything. There are fantastic people doing great work. But as a business, it is in the business of excitement and sensation. That is just the way it works. And once Donald Trump, reality star and cable news star, who, you know, knows how all this stuff works, you know, who knows how the sausage is made in a TV studio, once he's president, he's giving them everything they need. You know, it's amazing. Like, the news is breaking as long as his lips are moving. The news, it's big news, even if he's not saying something, because he might say something. What crazy thing will he say next? And that's why you have things like CNN showing his empty podium while he's getting ready to speak. You know, that's the definition of not news, right? A podium without a human being at it. But what it is excitement and it's anticipation. And reality TV thrives on that. And cable news thrives on it. And he just gave it to them by the bushel.
So how effectively has he used television as president?
I would argue not super effectively, actually. On one level, he has been as good with it as he has as a candidate, in that he still makes himself the protagonist of the news all the time. He's still feeding the beast. He's tweeting in particularly, which gives cable news constant content. And so he is keeping attention focused on him, but not necessarily using it to craft a coherent narrative or, say, to build support if he needs support, rather than just cementing the allegiance of the people who are also really with him. And part of the reason for that is that Donald Trump got elected, but TV kind of became the president, because in addition to being a TV personality and a TV star, he is an avid TV consumer. He makes the product and he is addicted to the product. Watches, by some reports, 4 to 8 hours of TV a day, depending on the day. So he gets up in the morning, he watches Fox and News or his, you know, taped episodes of Lou Dobbs or whatever, and gets worked up by that and tweets. And that starts another news cycle, and he tweets in response to that. And it creates a lot of attention. It doesn't necessarily create a narrative that benefits him, but the people of the world, whether we watch cable news or not, whether we're even following the news, we live inside this TV show because, you know, actual things that matter in the world are being determined by Donald Trump's interaction with television.
I want to take you back for a moment to the debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton during the last election, when he stepped forward and sort of walked behind her.
Yes.
Tell me what impression that created.
The stalker, the lurker moment. I think that particularly in the general election 2016, that was one of those moments that it absolutely reinforced two opposing impressions depending on which side of it you were on and how you already saw Trump. So sitting from one place, if you're a Hillary supporter, here is Donald Trump basically being a creep and being threatening and being menacing in a way that seems more suited to a mob boss than a president of the United States. But if you're on the other side of that, strength. As you say, a fighter. He's not going to back down. One thing that has been very key to him, you know, whether it's in reality TV or in the campaigns, is shows of dominance. And that's a visual show of dominance if you are sympathetic to seeing it that certain way. And that makes a meta argument to the voter, which is to say, I may not be the nicest guy in the world, but I'll be tough for you. I'll fight for you. And in a very polarized media environment, which in many ways was polarized by television, again, getting back to Fox News, cable, et cetera, et cetera. That can be enough if you are able to polarize yourself enough and present yourself as kind of the anti-hero whose enemies are worse than you are. That can get you over the line, and it did for him.
So we're about to enter another election season. To what extent do you think television is going to work as effectively for Donald Trump this time as it did the last?
I think that one thing that works against Donald Trump this time out is that a lot of the 2016 election in the media and in other ways that aren't as relevant to my book can be explained by everyone assuming that Donald Trump wasn't going to win. And so have him host Saturday Night Live. Why not? It'll be a laugh, and he's going to be a trivia question someday anyway. Who cares? We've now established that Donald Trump can win a presidential election. That's not going to be a factor then. There are things like CNN has learned not to air his rallies uncut beginning to end because they have reckoned with the fact that when he opens his mouth, you can't count on what coming out of it to be the truth. But they're still certainly going all in on his outrageous tweets. Cable news is still getting worked up when he holds a press gaggle on the White House lawn, basically setting their news agenda for the day. So in his favor, he still has this ability to make himself the protagonist of that 24-hour story where the president is always the star. That doesn't make him a shoo-in for a re-election. God knows, I'm not a political pundit. Nobody should like wager money on my impressions. But, you know, I think it is true. In the TV era, usually the candidates who have made themselves the protagonist of that election story have tended to win. So I'd say that he's got going for him.
I have to ask you about Sean Spicer appearing on Dancing with the Stars. Tell me your impression.
I think it's sad. I want to laugh at it about it, and there's something, you know, farcical about it, just ridiculous. And part of me says if Sean Spicer wants to go out in a chartreuse pirate shirt and dance every week, Godspeed. But I think like a lot of things today, it is farcical and tragic at the same time. Like here was a guy, to be, you know, a little more humorless about it, whose only job was to represent the White House and inform the American public. And dissembled and misinformed and straight out lied in blatant ways that didn't just not tell the truth, but sort of made a mockery of the idea of truth. Over and over again, like that's the thing that he's famous for. It's the only reason he's on Dancing with the Stars. If he was a boring press secretary who just gave straight answers, he wouldn't be on this reality show now. And I do think that it's a sad thing to sort of reward that by saying, ah, ha, 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 let's, you know, everybody lies. This is all just a big game and let's, you know, have some fun with it and, you know, bygones be bygones.
You know, what bothers me is that once again, lying is rewarded.
Yep. Yep. It's rewarded, or at least there's no consequence for it. You know, it is better to be a famous liar than a non-famous truth teller.
James, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks a lot, Diane. I enjoyed this.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Yurev-Livker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.